The head of the World Health Organization sent experts to China today to battle the coronavirus. He also had a message for the rest of the world.
Well, I think he's trying to say to governments all over the world, start getting ready. It's probably coming your way.
Since news of the coronavirus broke, some Chinese travelers abroad are getting identified with it.
By calling it Chinese virus, it's like generalizing the whole thing, and that's racism.
And President Trump has long said he'd like to remove U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Easier said than done.
We don't want to just leave and leave the Afghan government to face alone the Taliban, but we also know that we have to get out at some point, so this is a very difficult set of choices.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us this Monday. Today marked a small step forward in the battle against the coronavirus. Medical experts from the World Health Organization arrived in Beijing. They'd been trying to get into China for about 2 weeks. China had balked, though, raising questions about its sensitivity to receiving international help. Science journalist Laura Garrett says one of the key goals of the WHO team should be to fact-check the data they've gotten from Chinese officials.
It's very tricky. I was in the SARS epidemic in China throughout and in Hong Kong, and saw when the WHO teams arrived there for their official visits. And the problem is, you know, they get ushered around. They don't really see what any decent journalist would see on the ground. They have to follow the lead of the government host. But hopefully they're going to really get down to seeing some sense of the situation and whether or not China has the situation in hand.
Right. I mean, there's been lots said about the lessons learned since SARS in 2003 and China and transparency. But given what we know about transparency still in China, what do those WHO people hope to actually accomplish? Or are you seeing signs that suggest China may be open now to genuine scientific collaboration?
Well, I think we need to be fair and critical at the same time. On the fair side, China broke records on how fast they made viral samples available to the world, how fast they sequenced it so that we know the entire genetic structure of this virus. And the collaboration between sort of what I would call the lab bench level with other sort of lab bench level researchers elsewhere in the world has actually been quite good. If you look at really basic research papers about this virus, there's often huge teams of authors on these papers and they span the globe. So on that level, I would say congratulations, China. But when it comes to the kinds of details that now really matter to the world, that everybody's anxious to know answers to, here we have a problem. For example, exactly how many people are infected with this virus in China right now? We have no idea. How many people actually are sick due to this virus at this time? Well, we have official numbers that get released, but we have no idea how those official numbers relate to the reality. There's an innocent reason for that, which is they're running out of test kits and they're having a hard time keeping track of people. And the sheer scale of this is just overwhelming. There's a less benevolent side to it, which is that it has been noted that most of the early reporting seemed to be numbers that just got plucked out of the air. And once after January 20th, they started providing some more concrete numbers, it was noted that they always had exactly the same ratio of growth and the same ratio of relationship between asymptomatic, symptomatic, sick, cured, dined, such that it looked like it was a model with numbers being plugged into it.
The WHO Director General, Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, spoke with reporters in Geneva today. Here's what he said about the moment we're in.
We need to use the window of opportunity that we have now, because if you compare the number of cases in China and the rest of the world, in the rest of the world, we don't have more than above 300 cases. This is only a window of opportunity, and we should really work hard as one human race to fight this virus before it gets out of control.
Laura Garrett, how do you see what the head of the WHO is calling this window of opportunity?
Well, I think he's trying to say to governments all over the world, start getting ready. It's probably coming your way. Are you ready? What do you need? Have you trained your staff? What would be your approach to controlling this? If you're not a police state, if you're in a democracy, what will you do? What will be the nature of the laws you will exercise for quarantine? How are you going to deal with the supply chain? We're running out of masks all over the entire world. We're running out of medicines for everything because the entire supply chain on pharmaceuticals starts with active pharmaceutical ingredients made in China. And now with China shut off from the world, we're looking at a whole rolling chain of events that will involve everything from diabetes to cancer to heart disease. Everything needs to be thought out and thought out now, not waiting for it to be a crisis in your country.
Science journalist and author Lori Garrett. WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus also spoke today about the need to avoid politicizing the outbreak. He said the virus is a common enemy.
It attacks any human being, and that's how we should see the threat as one humanity against a virus which we don't know very well.
Since news of the coronavirus broke, many Chinese travelers have been treated not so kindly. The World's Rupa Shenoy spoke with Chinese students about what they've experienced. They're traveling across the U.S. to observe the presidential election.
Americans have been polite.
We feel welcome.
But Sammy Liu says people have also asked pointed questions.
Like, where do you come from? Which part of China do you come from?
Liu's a teacher from Guangdong, China. She's accompanying the group of about a dozen Chinese and Chinese-American students traveling across the country to watch the presidential election unfold. They're part of a privately funded program called the Presidential Youth Leadership Initiative. It's been around since 2003, but this year, Chinese students everywhere are traveling with suspicious eyes following them that they may have the coronavirus.
The normally bustling streets of London's Chinatown. The early evening after-work rush, more a hurried walk past half-empty restaurants.
In London, tourists have deserted Chinatown. In Rome, a bar posted a notice banning Chinese customers. In Australia, fake health notices fueled racist abuse toward Chinese people. And in Malaysia, the health minister warned the public that the spread of fake news connecting Chinese people and the coronavirus had become a more critical issue than the virus itself. After traveling to Iowa and New Hampshire, Josh Zhu, a Chinese international student in Boston, says the overall environment makes him feel like Chinese people are being blamed for the virus.
It shouldn't be Chinese fault. It's the virus fault.
But he says the way people are talking about the virus now, it plays into stereotypes.
They are making Chinese a figure of like someone who gets sick very easily.
Chinese Americans living in the U.S. have a different perspective. Sophia Zhang was born in Iowa, but lived in China until she was 11 and is now in middle school in Lexington, Massachusetts.
I don't really feel discriminated in school or anything. I mean, there's some disrespectful students, but overall, I mean, I feel welcome.
Still, reaction to the coronavirus, to her, seems a bit overblown.
China would do fine with the coronavirus. Obviously, they need to make a lot of changes. But I do believe that they'll gradually make them.
She's heard the virus called the Chinese virus, and that concerns her.
By calling it Chinese virus, it's like generalizing the whole thing. And that's racism. That's something that can incite xenophobia or whatever.
Meanwhile, the fear goes both ways. Just as Americans are worried about Chinese people carrying germs, Chinese parents have their own concerns about Americans.
American people is legal to hold a gun.
Evan He, a student from Guangdong, says more Chinese students are deciding against coming to the U.S. to study because they think of the U.S. as dangerous because people carry firearms.
It's a huge safety question for some Chinese family.
Sammy Liu, their teacher, agrees.
Their parents often talk to me. Two of my students, their parents don't want their children to come here.
But the U.S. is less dangerous than most Chinese people think, says Stephen Zhu, an international student in a high school in Reading, Massachusetts. He says people in both countries have areas where they need to grow and think differently, and he thinks they can.
I'm really optimistic about the future of China and about the relationship between the U.S. and China. They have to change themselves.
The futures of the U.S. and China are intertwined, Stephen says. And even amid divisions and misperceptions, their people need to find common ground. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
History was made last night at the Academy Awards.
And the Oscar goes to Parasite.
Parasite, directed by Bong Joon-ho of South Korea, became the first film in a language other than English to be awarded the Oscar for Best Picture. The film is about two families, one very rich, the other poor and scrappy. Parasite is both satire and tragedy, full of action and drama, and every person in it seems to have a major character flaw. Hyunjin Cho is the film curator at the Korean Cultural Center UK and joins us from London. Were you watching last night when Parasite won Best Picture?
Can I be honest? Actually, I fell asleep.
It was late at night, wasn't it? It's always the last
to
work.
So I caught it, when I just woke up in the middle of the night.
Yeah, so when you found out, what was your reaction?
Yeah, I was surprised. I think so was the team of Parasite. And I think everyone, we were very happily surprised.
Why the surprise? Because, I mean, there's been so much critical acclaim and, you know, it did really well at other awards ceremonies.
Yes, true. But, you know, Academy being the Academy, I think just never been done before. And it's just unprecedented. So we weren't sure, you know, if this Academy would just allow a foreign language film to win the Best Picture.
What did you think of Parasite?
I think it's an amazing piece of cinema. You know, I mean, of course, the subject matter it's tackling is very important. It's such a timely issue. And a lot of people can relate to that economic disparity that we all go through. But as a piece of cinema, you know, its inventiveness, mixing different genres and just making everything very original from the set design to the dialogue to how story unfolds. I think this all, you know, meticulous planning and execution, I think is something that everyone in the film industry really appreciated.
Some Western audiences have called Parasite satire. Do South Koreans see Parasite as satire?
Yes, I think there's definitely the element of satire. I mean, amazing thing about this film is that it cannot be sort of pinned down to just one genre. It's social commentary, it's a thriller, it's action, and it's also amazing kind of a black comedy. And I think there is a sense of sort of satire about the Hefs and how they kind of maintain their sort of lifestyle and dignity. But that's also dependent on a lot of people who serve their sort of lifestyle. So all of this is kind of been sort of hinted at in a very like nuanced way.
I mean, for me, it's clearly about class divisions in South Korea, maybe other places, and aspirational capitalism, the haves, the have-nots. Is that something Bong Joon-ho deals with in his other films?
Even from the very beginning, I think he was very interested in capturing sort of class divisions in a society early on, like with his debut feature called Barking Dogs Never Bite.
But when was what year was that?
That was in 2000.
So is Bong Joon-ho a household name in South Korea? Was he before all this international excitement around Parasite?
He's one of the most well-regarded directors from South Korea. You know, he only has like 6 films under his belt over the past 2 decades, but each film kind of made a very distinct sort of voice. So he's one of the filmmakers from Korea, I think, who has a very distinct artistic voice, at the same time has a kind of great box office sort of power.
I mean, class division and income inequality are big talking points generally in the U.S. right now. But from what I've been reading, it sounds like a theme that South Korean filmmakers at large have taken on for years. How far back does it go? And why did filmmakers in South Korea grab onto this as a theme?
I think an example is class division would be The Housemaid from 1960, which actually Bong Joon-ho talked about quite a lot in his press interviews. The film was made by the director called Kim Gi-young, and Bong Joon-ho considered him as his mentor. And that film from 1960 already sort of tackles the sort of the issue of the rise of the middle class. And the kind of working class, they cannot quite follow or keep up with this economic prosperity that South Korea was going through since the 1960s after the Korean War. So I think that's something that internally that was kind of going through for a while. And
Hyojin Cho is the film curator at the Korean Cultural Center UK. She's also the director of London's annual Korean Film Festival. Thanks very much for speaking with us about Bong Joon-ho and South Korean cinema. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It is budget time again in Washington. The White House put out its annual spending blueprint this afternoon. And once again, the Trump administration wants to dramatically slash funding for foreign aid. Administration officials say it's part of an effort to decrease the national debt, but at the same time, the budget proposal does allocate some extra dollars for border security. Sarah Bermeo is associate director at the Duke Center for International Development and is going to help us on the foreign aid slice of the budget. As in previous years, the Democratic-controlled Congress is expected to vote against the proposed cuts. If it's likely not going to pass, why does it matter that Trump has proposed it? I mean, how does this proposal impact our relationships around the world?
This administration, in each budget that it has sent to Congress, has proposed dramatic cuts to foreign aid. Each time Congress has pushed back, and yet the administration still keeps proposing the cuts. It really suggests that this is part of the Trump administration's pulling back from interactions with the rest of the world. Every year, these budget cuts get overturned, and yet the fact that he keeps proposing them suggests that he really is sending a signal that he does not support foreign aid.
And Republicans, how do they feel about these proposed cuts to foreign aid?
The cuts that were proposed today are very similar to cuts that have been proposed in previous budgets by this administration. And in each time, members of Congress from both parties have pushed back against these with bipartisan support. We may be in a potentially different situation post-impeachment, but as recently as August of last year, strong supporters of President Trump, including Senator Lindsey Graham, were pushing back against proposed cuts, saying that cuts to foreign aid would undermine significant security and anti-terrorism efforts.
Without the cuts, how does the current U.S. foreign aid spending compare to other wealthy countries?
The United States spends less than 0.2% of GDP on foreign aid. That puts us in the neighborhood of countries like Portugal or Estonia and well behind many of our allies, such as the United Kingdom, Germany, and France, who spend a significantly larger portion of their GDP on foreign aid.
When we're looking at a proposed cut of something like close to $12 billion in this part of the budget, how significant are those cuts when it comes to actual savings?
In terms of our overall U.S. budget, they're minuscule. In terms of the foreign aid budget, they're significantly important. Well, this amount of money is actually quite small from the U.S. budget perspective. For a small, poor country, the amount of money we're giving them can be quite significant. And so it can be a relatively inexpensive way to have a big impact in another place.
What do we not get in, like, intangible dividends when we don't spend a reasonable amount of money, like matching other wealthy countries around the world?
Part of it, of course, is where we stand with other countries and our ability to pressure them to spend money. If we're not seen as doing our fair share in terms of our percent of GDP, we don't really have much to pressure them on.
Does that kind of entail like a race to the bottom? If we're not spending and other countries follow suit, is that bad news for countries that are actually in need of that foreign aid?
So far, it hasn't seemed to entail a race to the bottom. If anything, some small countries are very proud of the amount of money that they spend on foreign aid and believe that that gives them some moral leadership authority over other countries like the United States, which spend a much smaller proportion of our GDP on foreign aid. This could be a very short-sighted way of thinking about our interactions with developing countries and can lead to long-term problems that pose security threats. There's the oft-used quip by former General Mattis, if you spend less money on foreign aid, you need to buy more ammunition in the long term. In the last years when foreign aid budget has been cut, we've seen letters co-signed by over 100 former U.S. military personnel pushing back on the cuts, saying that they will make the United States less secure.
Sarah Bermeo, Associate Director at the Duke Center for International Development. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Imagine a grand hotel from an era of opulence. Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin's preferred place to unwind. Now imagine that hotel in a state of total disrepair. That is a situation in a town in the Republic of Georgia. After the Soviet Union collapsed, some resorts became shelters for refugees, a temporary solution that persists now almost 30 years later. The BBC's Rehan Dimitri reports from Georgia.
Two boys are kicking a football around a magnificent but shabby entrance hall. The parquet floor is battered and broken. Above them, a giant crystal chandelier still hangs from the ceiling. This is one of 22 abandoned Soviet spa hotels, known as sanatoriums, in the western Georgian town of Tsakhaltubo, and little luxury remains for its current inhabitants.
We have no amenities here. Each family lives in one old hotel room.
Rusudan Khurtidze has been living in this building since 1992. Back then, she was among tens of thousands of Georgians forced from their homes in the civil war over the separatist region of Abkhazia. Many families were given shelter in the empty hotel rooms. The accommodation, they were told, would be temporary.
It's not a great place to bring up children. Water pipes were installed only a year ago. Before that, we used to bring water from downstairs.
The Georgian government has relocated most of the 12,000 refugees originally housed in Tsaltubo. About 5,000 people are still waiting to move out, says Leyla Ashordia, a former refugee herself. Leyla now runs a charity called Acting Together, which supports the refugee families.
For a very long time, many of us were thinking that today or tomorrow we will go back to our homes, but this wait lasted for 27 years.
The leaking water pipes, the poverty amidst the former glory of the grand old hotels, creates a feeling of hopelessness in Tsaltubo. But it wasn't always like this. Tsaltubo was once a top holiday destination for Soviet workers, famous for its natural hot springs.
Wow. This is what used to be Stalin's private bathhouse. I'm walking down four stairs and I'm now standing in what used to be his swimming pool. It's decorated with white and blue tiles. Two large windows here, so you can look at the blue sky. The entire spa town was built because Joseph Stalin himself believed in the healing powers of the hot springs. I'm now walking up the stairs and there are no railings. Everything that contained metal was stolen for scrap metal.
The glory days of Tsaltubo ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the civil war that followed. Now there are plans to invest millions of dollars into the restoration of the spa hotels. But first, their permanent guests must be resettled. Until then, Tsaltubo will remain a relic of the Soviet past and a home for the homeless.
The BBC's Rehan Dimitri with that story from Tsaltubo in the Republic of Georgia. You're listening to The World. To build a successful political revolution, you need a cause, a chant, a banner, and one other key ingredient.
People, they need a physical place, a public place where they can meet.
In Lebanon, activists are demanding a new political system. That has not happened, but they have reclaimed a few scarce public spaces in Beirut. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. Deportation is a big worry, not just who gets deported and why, but what happens to those people after they're sent back to the places that they had been trying to escape from. A new report is confirming some of the worst fears about El Salvador. Dozens of people have been killed there after being denied asylum and deported from the U.S. Some of those victims were transgender women who fled persecution. The World's Jorge Valencia has this story about Camila Diaz.
The last day of Camila Diaz's life, she left work just before 6 p.m. And like every other day, she wore her long brown hair down. She was a sex worker on a corner in central San Salvador. And she was sending voice notes to one of her friends about other transgender women who worked down the street. They told me they were jealous of my hair, she says in this message. And I don't get it because my hair's a mess. But it wasn't just jealousy. Diaz had been receiving threats for days from other sex workers. They want her to stop working that corner. They say they're going to beat me up, she says in the message. And then she adds, I know I can't let them push me around, Diaz says. But at the same time, I know the kind of people they're friends with. I received these messages from a friend of Camila Diaz, who told me the rest of the story from that night. When Diaz stopped communicating, her friend started looking for her. The friend asked to remain anonymous because she's afraid of retaliation. The friend tells me Diaz was assaulted by police officers that night. The officers took her away in handcuffs in the back of a pickup truck. Local news reports include similar details. The friend says she and other transgender people in El Salvador face ridicule or worse when they approach authorities. She tells me the mere fact of having a different gender identity than what people are used to, that's enough for them to not take you seriously. Camila Diaz had been deported from the United States a year earlier. She had come seeking asylum for violence she faced as a transgender woman in San Salvador. But hers is far from being the only case of someone who was killed after being returned.
We found at least 138 killings that occurred after deportation between 2013 and 2019.
Elizabeth Kennedy helped put together a report for Human Rights Watch about people who were deported to El Salvador and later killed. She says the figure of 138 deaths is conservative because many homicides are not reported.
I think this is a very inconvenient topic because, you know, obviously El Salvador doesn't want to know because no country wants to admit that they're not protecting their citizens. And the United States doesn't want to know either because it is a violation of national and international law.
Kennedy says both Salvadorian and U.S. government officials are to blame for not doing enough to guarantee the safety of people fleeing violence. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials did not respond to a request for comment by deadline. Beatriz Campos works on migrant rights for the Salvadorian government. Campos says she's alarmed by the new Human Rights Watch report. She says El Salvador does have an initiative to help people returning from the U.S., but it's not enough.
El Estado creo que no tiene esos mecanismos para la asistencia integral total.
We have a long ways to go, she says. In the case of Camila Diaz, she fled her native country because of the threats she faced as a sex worker. Her friend tells me that's the only job many transgender women can find.
Entonces ella comenzó a entrar en pánico y lo que hizo fue mejor irse.
Y pues, Diaz panicked and decided to get out, the friend says. She traveled through Mexico and eventually to San Diego.
Un tiempo estaba así como un poco retraída, deprimida, quizás por toda la situación que había pasado.
After Diaz was deported, her friend says she was depressed. She eventually went back to working on a street corner only because she had no other way of making a living. A few months later, Diaz was assaulted in the middle of the night and died on a hospital bed alone. For the World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
In his State of the Union speech, President Trump talked about the war in Afghanistan.
We are working to finally end America's longest war and bring our troops back home.
At the height of the war in Afghanistan, the U.S. had 100,000 troops on the ground there. For the past 10 years, Washington has been steadily reducing its troop presence, down now to about 13,000. The Trump administration plans to reduce those numbers even further to as low as 8,500 troops. And now NATO allies are considering a withdrawal of their troops from Afghanistan. Nicholas Burns is a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. He's also an unpaid advisor to the Joe Biden campaign. And he joins me, as he often does on Monday, in our studio. So I want to start with Afghanistan, Nick. As peace talks between the U.S. and the Taliban have stalled in recent months, we've seen six American soldiers die in Afghanistan since January 1st, two of them over this weekend. What does that tell us about where the war is at right now?
This is a very difficult moment for the United States. I mean, President Trump, I think, is correct that we have to draw down our presence there. Eventually, we've been fighting for nearly 19 years. We have 13,000 troops there. We are still suffering casualties, both dead and wounded, not in great numbers. And yet it's difficult to negotiate with the Taliban. Can you really trust that the Taliban would honor any agreement made with the United States? And even if the United States and the Taliban agree, say, on a ceasefire, on a phased withdrawal, say, to 5,000 American troops, which is one of the issues they've been discussing, how about the Afghan government? That's our partner here. Mm. That's the government of Ashraf Ghani that we've been supporting. They haven't even begun to talk to the Taliban yet. So I think this diplomatic kabuki dance of sorts is really in its first phase. But I expect this to continue for some months, if not into 2021, before we can have an agreement between the Taliban and the Afghan government that can be trusted and therefore bring down the level of our troops.
And Nick, where does that diplomacy stand, especially in terms of where the Afghan government fits into this? Because I know the first phase, they weren't really included, and there were a lot of hard feelings about that. Is there a push to get them more involved?
Well, I think President Ghani wants to be involved, but it's not the right time yet. Of course, it's controversial in his own community to negotiate with the Taliban because there have been a tremendous number of Taliban attacks on Afghan civilians and on the Afghan military. There also have been insider attacks against the U.S. military, meaning some of the Afghan forces with whom our troops are working have turned on them. So this is a very bitter experience for the United States. And it also has repercussions for the NATO alliance because we have about 40 allies and partner nations with us in Afghanistan. They've been with us for nearly two decades. As they see the United States inching forward to draw down, they, of course, want to bring their troops home as well.
I mean, given Donald Trump's inclination to opt for often the best personal political kind of solution, how concerned are you that there will just be U.S. troops leaving?
Well, there is that scenario where in an election year, it might be to the president's political advantage to show that he's made progress in getting us out of these forever wars, as Iraq and Afghanistan have been called. He's already taken American troops really out of Syria as a strategic force. We've drawn down some American forces in Iraq and now Afghanistan. That is a possibility. I would hope the president would really do his best for the country, which is to do this responsibly and not for political reasons.
So, Nick, you mentioned Syria. Let's pivot to Syria. The Syrian government, backed by its ally Russia, has been maintaining for the past 2 months its military offensive in Idlib province. It is the last stronghold of Syrian opposition. There are Turkish and Syrian forces attacking the province from both sides. It's a miserable situation for the people living there. And it's been going on for years. It is devastating, but I'm just wondering, do you see it as simply more of the same, or do you see it marking an end game in sight with different sets of diplomatic considerations at this point?
Well, this brutal fight in Idlib province in the north of Syria is probably the end game, Marco, of a 9-year civil war that has torn the country apart. 7 million refugees of the 22 million Syrian people.
Direct effect on the European continent, of course.
Direct effect on Europe, direct effect on neighboring states like Iraq and Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon. This is one of the most bitter, divisive, bloody conflicts that we've seen in the world over the last decade. The Russians, the Syrian army, and the Iranians, how about that for a motley crew, all teaming up now to bomb civilian populations, drive them out as refugees. And this is a replay of what we saw in Aleppo. The most brutal bombing in modern history on civilian populations was in Aleppo a year and a half ago. And so I'm afraid we're looking at a humanitarian disaster. Just in recent days, there's been a flow of refugees out of the Idlib province. You can't blame these people. They're really running for their lives. And yet, there's really no way for the United States, because we have a hands-off policy in Syria right now, to counter. We're not willing to put, and we shouldn't put, military forces in to block the Russian-Syrian advance. The answer to this was years ago during the Obama administration. We could have set up zones to protect the refugees. We didn't do that. Now the refugees are at the mercy of the most merciless governments in the world.
Nicholas Burns, a former ambassador to NATO. He's also a professor of diplomacy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Nick, thanks for your thoughts. Have a great week.
Thank you, Marco.
Anti-government protests in Lebanon started back in October. People from all of the country's main religious groups have been coming out into the streets to demand the end of their sectarian-based government system. That has not happened, but protesters say there have been some notable successes. One of them is the reclaiming of public space that's long been scarce across Lebanon. Rebecca Collard has our report from Beirut.
It seems like every time a Lebanese politician speaks publicly or the government announces new reforms, this is the response. Protesters block the main bridge in Beirut that connects the east and west sides of the city. It doesn't take long for brightly lit food carts to show up. At one point, there was even a fridge and a flat screen TV out there with a sign that said, "Revolution and chill." Talal Zeidan says he always comes when there's a call to shut the road.
People, they need a platform. They need a physical place, a public place where they can meet.
And in Lebanon, that is hard to find. There are a few public parks. The Corniche along Beirut's waterfront is open to all. But the lack of public space is something people here complain about a lot. Zeidan says it's had a detrimental impact on the fabric of Lebanese society.
And communication is the key to break stereotypes and to know each other. So
Zeidan says it's all part of a political strategy. The sectarian political powers want to keep public spaces closed. It's all about keeping people divided, he says, scared of each other and therefore dependent on their sectarian leaders.
This protest, it created a public spaces. It created a public awareness that the people, that they are really reunited. Even if they do belong to different religious backgrounds, they are united.
Protesters drag a metal gate into the street near Martyrs Square. This has become a center of Lebanon's protest movement. All the roads into the square have been blocked for months, creating a massive pedestrian-only area that has hosted the largest demonstrations in the city since October. But even when the square isn't filled with chanting protesters, people come just to wander around the tents and visit the food stands. Lucien Borgelli is a filmmaker and theater director. He's among the dozens of protesters trying to prevent authorities from reopening Martyrs Square to traffic. Like Zeidan, Borgelli says that Lebanon's sectarian divisions have been fostered by Lebanon's political elites.
This would be killed with a lot of public spaces, this feeling of not knowing the other, of hating the other.
That's not to say that today people don't mix in Lebanon. In some shopping districts and bars and restaurants, you can find people of all sectarian backgrounds. But there are few open, free public spaces. And it wasn't always like this in Lebanon. Martyrs Square used to be a busy public space. The square was named after a group of Arab nationalists, Christians and Muslims, executed here by the Ottomans in 1916. Without the symbolic statue in the middle of the square honoring them, it would be almost unrecognizable today. During much of Lebanon's civil war, Martyrs Square was a front line. It was destroyed in the fighting and never fully restored. With the exception of these recent protests, this square has mostly been a big empty space right in the middle of the city. Online, you can find dozens of videos and photo montages from the golden era of Martyrs Square. Palm trees rise out of grass-covered lawns and gardens. People stroll past shops and restaurants and by a large fountain. And that's how this man, who gave his name only as Naji, remembers it.
It was a beautiful place. It was a green place. You had a sound that you don't hear anymore.
I meet Naji in a shop that sells cigars and whiskey a few blocks from Martyrs Square. He's now 63, but when he was young, he would come to the square from where he lived in the southwest of the city. He says buses would arrive from all over the country. Tram lines ran through the center. There was a bustling market where people from every part of Lebanon came to hawk goods. Naji's friend pulls out an old photo of the square on his phone.
You see a mosque and you see many churches. But despite that, this area hasn't a religious identity. It was a downtown, for everybody.
That's not to pretend that everything was perfect before the Civil War, but the public square did provide more opportunities for encounter and the sharing of physical space. And the war didn't only destroy public space in the center of Beirut. It also put a stop to most of the country's public transport. Naji recalls those days when Lebanon had a rail system that ran the length of the country, connecting towns and villages, as well as buses and trams.
Which kind of people take the metro in London, or in Paris, or in New York? Any kind of people. The people were mixed.
Today, Lebanon has a small network of buses, but no rail system at all. Borgelli says this, too, is no accident. He says Lebanon's sectarian political parties know that public space and public transport has the potential to unify people. And that, he says, is where Lebanon's protest movement has succeeded.
One of the great things that happened during this revolution is that people found these, reclaimed these spaces and used them for public debates, for discussions, for sitting together.
It's a first step, say the protesters, in bringing down a system that has long kept people divided. For the World, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
People in Ireland are looking at a very different political future today, something of a revolution in the ballot box. That's a quote from the leader of Ireland's left-wing Sinn Féin party, Mary Lou MacDonald, describing this weekend's historic election.
It's a big statement of change. It is a big statement that this is no longer a two-party system. It's a statement that people want a different type of government.
Sinn Féin beat Ireland's two traditional ruling parties, but just barely. No party captured an outright majority, so now, because it's a parliamentary system, the real fun begins. Time to build a ruling coalition. Regardless of what happens next, Sinn Féin's success has taken many by surprise, including former Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern.
I think we saw their poll rising all through last year, but not to this extent. They did very poorly in the local and European elections last summer. And from that, they quickly had a review of their own strategies and policies. And to say that that was a successful review is an understatement, because what they decided to do was to focus on homelessness, housing and health. And they went after those three issues. So that resonated strongly with the electorate, and ones that the government had not been seen to be dealing that well with. So I think that's where they got their strength was. They had a narrow focus, went after those issues, had some very good candidates and good performers on television. And Mary Lou MacDonald, who was a relatively new leader of Sinn Féin, having taken over from Gerry Adams only 2 years ago, she performed very well in the election campaign.
So listeners may be scratching their heads as we're talking about Sinn Féin and the Republic of Ireland, because when you were Prime Minister, you signed the Good Friday Agreement along with Tony Blair, bringing peace to the North, which is really where Sinn Féin has their roots. So how different is the Sinn Féin party you knew then from the party that topped these polls in the Republic of Ireland?
Sinn Féin, to be fair with them, over the last 20 years have been moving towards mainstream. Some of the policies might be considered radical, but they have been trying to move to more mainstream politics than, other parties.
So your party, Fianna Fáil, had previously said they'd never go into coalition with Sinn Féin. Is it time to change that view?
I think there'll be a lot of discussion. The seats are still coming in. The count won't be finished probably until tomorrow late tonight. So I think there's going to be a lot of analysis now about who'll do what. At the moment, Fine Gael have said they will not deal with Sinn Féin. Fianna Fáil have said they will not deal with Sinn Féin, maybe not as strong. Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil have said they won't deal with each other. So as you know, in this political kind of a game, somebody was going to have to change their position. So I think there'll be a lot of soul searching and a lot of probably turmoil around for the next few weeks. And then the dust will settle and people will have to see what kind of a combination of a government they can put together. So it means people have to change from the positions they've had. So I think it'll be an interesting few weeks, but I do honestly believe it'll take a few weeks before you get clear water.
So what path do these results indicate? What will be different in Ireland if Sinn Féin can consolidate its power?
I wouldn't put too much money down on a bet that says what happened on Saturday will happen again in a year's time or 2 years' time. But this time, a large proportion of young people listened to what the campaign was about, change and about more radical politics, and they bought into it. Now, they bought into it, in fairness to them, for good reasons. A lot of young people can't afford housing. A lot of young people are staying at home with their mother and fathers far older than they normally traditionally would. So in this case, the Sinn Féin policy attracted a lot of support. And people said, OK, let's give them a try. So I think from the electorate's point of view, it was understandable. The level of it and the spread of it was remarkable.
Finally, do you think this will lead to a referendum on a united Ireland now? And should there be one?
My own view on that is that it will happen eventually, but not too quick, and certainly not in the next few years. For this reason, and this reason maybe only, that the preparatory work of how that could come about, all of that job is going to take some years, and it hasn't been done. So to prematurely try to press for a border poll, as it's called, or United Ireland or New Ireland, it's not the time to do that. And to do it in the short term would prove to be a big mistake, in my view.
Former Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern speaking with us about Sinn Féin topping the polls in Irish elections. Thank you for your time.
Not at all. I hope that's good. And listen, Marco, you mind yourself, and nice to talk to you.
And here's an update on another weekend vote we previewed for you. Switzerland has voted to ban discrimination based on sexual orientation, a big win for the country's LGBT community. They've argued that Switzerland has lagged far behind other European countries on gay rights. No longer, though. 63% of Swiss voters back the anti-discrimination measure. That's more support than polls had suggested. Anna Rosenwasser is with the Swiss Lesbian Organization.
The polls were rather positive, but it was still a relief to see that they were right about the very clear yes of Switzerland's population. It's one of many steps to take, but there are certainly more steps that we do have to take, one of them being marriage equality, which Switzerland still does not have. And we're taking all the motivation of today's vote to fight for that marriage equality, which the parliament will talk about shortly.
Switzerland's parliament is expected to vote on whether to legalize same-sex marriage this spring. As for the ban on anti-gay discrimination, the Swiss parliament had actually passed that measure in 2018, but opponents had gathered enough signatures to force last weekend's referendum. They argued the anti-discrimination law could have an impact on freedom of speech and defended some church leaders who don't want to bless same-sex partnerships. David Troxel is with the Young Swiss People's Party and an organizer for the No campaign. We accept the result, Troxel says. It tells us that there is a demand for more protection. He continues, we clearly disagree, but obviously this argument has won. And that's the world on this Monday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.